Good afternoon, Juno. It's almost 3 p.m., and it's time for another edition of A Juno Afternoon. I'm Ken Fix. I'm going to be your host for today. And on the show, we'll be talking with Elaine Schroeder, who will be here to highlight Wednesday's noontime vigil for Hiroshima Day. We'll get a profile of the City, Borough, and Juno Lands Department with guest Greg Cheney. We'll hear a short Spirit of Alaska Youth story and a new story by Juno's own Pete Griffin called Highbush Cranberry Jelly. These guests, plus Writer's Almanac, Bird Note, music, and more for Tuesday, August 5th, 2014. Stay tuned. National Native News is up first.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. A community loan fund in South Dakota is taking steps to build its internal capacity to serve the needs of growing larger businesses on the Pine Ridge Reservation. As Jim Kent reports, work is being done to increase awareness of business financing solutions and create or expand more businesses.
Lakota Funds has assisted in the startup of hundreds of small businesses on the Pine Ridge Reservation since it was founded 28 years ago. The Lakota Fund's executive director, Tawny Brunch, says those businesses are growing, and there are still many larger businesses that continue to face barriers in accessing capital.
Traditionally, we served more like the sole proprietorships, the quilters and the individual, maybe contractors, the smaller businesses. But we surveyed businesses and found that there are actually businesses out there who need more than $100,000 and are having a hard time accessing that capital, and that's keeping their businesses from growing.
At least two of those businesses are generating sales annually of over $3 million, says Tawny Brunch. A recent financial award from the City Foundation will permit Lakota Funds to build its internal capacity to handle larger loan requests by big businesses located on the reservation. Businesses on the Pine Ridge Reservation that need higher capital lending include those in the construction and building industry, as well as others in grocery and retail. The City Foundation's award provides Lakota Funds the ability to market in order to attract the kind of capital the Community Loan Fund will need to finance larger loans. For National Native News, I'm Jim Kent.
Alaska veterans turned out for the first Veterans Affairs stand down in the community of Bethel. The recent event put on by the government agency helps connect veterans with services and benefits. KYUK's Charles Enoch has this report.
The most visible benefit to veterans was the several container vans full of military surplus gear, but Rick Epperson, Rural Health Program Manager for the Alaska Department of Military and Veterans Affairs, says the gear was intended to connect veterans with bigger benefits they've earned.
Our main purpose here is to talk with veterans about many of the benefits that many of them don't even know that they qualify for.
Francis Udrich was an acting first sergeant for the 143rd Airborne, serving in Kuwait and Iraq in 2006. And 2007. He says signing up for benefits is important.
It helped me since I came back. I have more privileges and benefits from being disabled.
Some of those benefits are geared towards health care for veterans, which they can now get closer to home. Susan Yeager is the director for the Alaska VA healthcare system.
In May 2012, we were able to sign 26 contracts, sharing agreements with different Native organizations across Alaska. And so what that agreement says, any eligible veteran that's seen, then we, the VA, will reimburse for that care.
Yeager says over 100 veterans from the YK Delta signed up for the VA health care plan during their visit last week. Mike Frew, director of the VA Home Loan Program in Washington, D.C., was also in Bethel for the stand-down. In addition, he traveled to the YK Delta villages to work on memorandums of understanding that will help Alaska Native veterans get direct home loans from the VA.
I hope it helps a lot of veterans. I know that the home loan program we've had for 70 years, we've helped 21 million veterans and their families purchase homes, raise their children, and live a life and own a part of the American dream.
The MOU will make low-interest home loans available to Alaska Native veterans. The loans will have better rates than the standard VA home loans and can be used for remodeling. Last week, the first MOU was signed for Metlakatla in southeast Alaska, the state's only official reservation. Frew says 10 YK Delta villages have already signed their intent to sign an MOU. In Bethel, I'm Charles Enoch.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kawanic Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation, and by the law firm of Sanosky, Chambers, Saxe, Miller & Munson, advocating Native American interests throughout the United States, with offices in New Mexico, California, Alaska, and Washington, D.C.
Alaska Native shareholders, members of a federally recognized tribe, and their families can sign up for health insurance on the marketplace anytime. Visit healthcare.gov/tribal or call 1-800-318-2596.
A message from the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
And before we get going with my first guest, I do have an on-air announcement about the Eagle Crest Board. They will be meeting this Thursday, August 7th, at 5:30 p.m. in the City Hall Conference Room, number 237. For more information, you can contact Matt Lillard at 790-2000, extension 221. And now I'd like to introduce my first guest, Dr. Elaine Schroeder. She's here to talk about the noontime vigil for Hiroshima Day, which is tomorrow, but we're also going to talk about probably a few other related topics. She's got a long-time involvement in women's rights and peace and justice in the community, and I'd like to welcome her to the show. Hi, Elaine. How are you?
I am fine. It's a great day.
Okay.
It's beautiful.
All right. Let's go a little bit into your background here. How did you initially get started in the peace movement and justice and fighting for rights and whatnot?
Well, right after I got out of Peace Corps in India. Well, actually, before I went into Peace Corps, I was at the University of Illinois when the Vietnam War was gearing up, and my husband and I and several other people became involved in protesting the war in Vietnam, and then I graduated and I was off to India to be a Peace Corps volunteer. And when I got back and started graduate school at the University of Washington in Seattle, the Vietnam War was in full swing, and I had just lived in a poor Asian village for over 2 years, and I knew I could feel viscerally the suffering of the Vietnamese who were unjustly invaded by U.S. troops on a trumped-up story about the Gulf of Tonkin incident, they called it, which was now historians know was a complete fabrication. But also relevant to Hiroshima Day, which will be having a vigil tomorrow. When I was at University of Washington, I went to hear Helen Caldicott, Dr. Helen Caldicott. Have you ever heard of her? She's the founder of Physicians for Social Responsibility. And it was in the days, you're younger than me, so you don't probably remember this, but it was there was a clock about how many minutes left till nuclear obliteration. And I went to hear her speak, and I got my first whiff of the danger of nuclear weapons. And in fact, I went home from that talk. I'm young. I'm in my mid-20s at this point. And it was like I went to the doctor for a routine checkup and I was told that I had a life-threatening illness. I went home and I was in shock when I heard the facts from Helen Caldicott for days and days. And then I turned that into activism around peace and justice issues, war issues, and specifically nuclear weapons. So that's how it all began.
All right, and specific to this, I suppose we need to digress just a smidge and go into history. The end of World War II, where we had basically beaten the Germans, and we'd had our run-ins with Japan, who had joined the Axis back in 1941, I believe. And then, of course, we had Pearl Harbor that basically brought us into the war, and also the invasion on the Aleutian Islands. That's the only time our U.S. territory has really ever been invaded.
Yeah.
So, you know, we were kind of drug into that rather unceremoniously. We're trying to stay out of it, but
yeah.
That didn't work. We were going to get hauled into this, you know, sooner or later. Once Hitler and Germany were defeated, now we had the Russians, which basically had promised us that they would help us out with the Japan situation. And they were going to be invading on the northern front. And while we're still pushing in, you know, to mainland Japan, and we actually did quite a few bombing raids on Japanese cities. You know, of course, the Japanese are fighting back, but
fire bombings. Right?
Yeah, and we were at least we were kind enough to drop leaflets and tell them that we were going to be bombing because you know we actually had done that and gave them a little bit of advanced warning. The Japanese showed no signs of surrendering, and of course, I'm not going to go into the wartime atrocities, but there was a lot of that committed back then, and there was a lot of accountability after the Japanese unconditional surrender. But in the meantime, we were developing the atomic bomb. Oppenheimer and his crew were out in the desert, and you know they produced the first atomic explosion at Trinity, and that happened just a short time before we actually put two bombs together. And I should be letting you tell this story, but at least I'm pretty fresh on this, so I know this one. The two bombs were Little Boy, which was the first one that was dropped on Hiroshima, and Fat Man, which was the second bomb, and that was dropped on Nagasaki. The first one was a uranium bomb, and the second one was a plutonium fusion bomb.
So, and, yes, on on August 6th, 1940.
August 6th, and then the 8th.
Right. On August 6th, we dropped the first atomic bomb on Hiroshima and then 2 days later on Nagasaki. And over 100,000 people were killed. A large portion of them killed almost instantly. And then over time, tens of thousands died of nuclear illness, as it was called then.
Yeah, fallout, the radiation.
Right, and pretty gruesome deaths. The reason we're recognizing this day is to join with people all over the world to promote the banning, the disarmament of nuclear weapons. So right now, it might be, I don't know how the dateline works, but either on August 6th in Hiroshima and all over Japan, there are yearly commemorations for this of this event, and the ethos of these commemorations are "Let this never happen again." About 12 years ago, my husband and I housed a Japanese exchange teacher from Hiroshima, and she, to this day, is very active in the anti-nuclear movement. And her name is Chiseko Miura, so people may know her because she taught at Harborview School for 9 months. And through her, I've learned firsthand the generations, because she's elderly now, the generations of people who have been impacted by that nuclear attack. And it definitely touches me as much as the plight of Vietnamese villagers touched me decades and decades ago.
Can you tell us a little bit more what you know about her?
About Chiseko?
Yes.
Well, I should rather talk about Sadako. Have you ever heard of Sadako? And have you noticed that a lot on Hiroshima Day, there's a peace bird that... Have you ever been to the 4th of July parade?
Yes.
Yes. And have you seen Juno People for Peace and Justice holding peace cranes?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Well, we're going to have peace cranes there. And do you know the connection between Hiroshima Day, the bomb, and the peace cranes? Remember that?
Okay, let me tell the listeners because they may not know.
Okay. So Sadako Sasaki was a 2-year-old child who was right near Ground Zero in Hiroshima, and she was actually thrown out the window by the blast. And when her mother went to get her, she thought she was dead, but she survived. And she actually lived another 10 years. She died when she was 12 of radiation poisoning. And Sadako became famous in Japan because when she was in the hospital dying over a long process, she started folding origami peace cranes, like the peace cranes we hold in the 4th of July parade. And we're going to have some of them. Now, this is all about this event at Marine Park tomorrow, Wednesday, from noon to 1. So we're going to be there with peace cranes, and we're going to have a silent vigil. And we have a banner, and there's a statue of Sadako on the banner because she's the most prominent. It's a large statue at the Hiroshima Peace Park. So this is very close to our hearts because the Japanese teacher who was here has continued to be in touch with us in Juneau and has asked us to work on nuclear disarmament. And, of course, our hearts are in the same place. So let me give you a little bit of the schedule tomorrow. I said it's a silent vigil. I will begin with just a minute or two of opening remarks, and then we will have approximately an hour of silence, and I'll ring a gong. And at the end of the event, Pastor Phil Campbell from Northern Light United Church will close the vigil at 1 p.m. So people are welcome to come for 5 minutes, for the whole hour, at any part of the event. Just walk in and be with us. If you feel like sitting down, there's some benches there. Bring a chair, and it'll be a very peaceful, as it should be, vigil.
Okay, Dr. Schroeder, let me get your thoughts on modern-day conflict and warfare that's going on now.
Sure.
What troubles you, and where do you think we're headed, and what do you think we could do about it?
Well, the U.S. seems to be in continuous war. We, of course, are pulling out of, we have pulled out of Iraq, and we still have quite a few so-called military advisors there. And we entered the war, of course, again, very much like the Vietnam War, with lies, and that was that Iraq had weapons, nuclear weapons, weapons of mass destruction, which, of course, the UN inspectors had told us beforehand that they had searched and there was none, and, of course, none were found. These are war, opportunistic wars for oil and for basically, as you said a moment ago, for the profits of corporations. When I said a moment ago, that was off the record.
That was when we were off the air.
When we were off the air. But we were talking beforehand.
But we do have to say
profit.
Who profits. Yeah,
and there's corporate profit. And so in Afghanistan, of course, that was supposed to be invaded due to the terrorist attacks of 9/11, obviously 9/11, those were criminal events and should have been handled in criminal court. It was totally inappropriate, and it was a huge loss of treasure for the United States and human beings, both Afghan and American human beings. And for the money we spend on these opportunistic, illegal wars, we could fund free health care for everybody in the United States, early childhood development, I mean, you name it, we could fund it. So that's basically my feeling about U.S. military involvement, and we'd be a much healthier and happier nation. In fact, those nations, if you think about it, let's talk about Norway, Finland, Sweden. Think of the nations that have nothing to do with war. And if you take a look at the gross national happiness index, those are the countries where people are happiest because their taxes go for human betterment, not hurting other human beings.
Well, that's something that we should aspire to. That sounds pretty good to me. I will make the personal comment that, you know, I've got a daughter that served over in Iraq and her husband. And, you know, they were, you know, they would tell me the stories, you know, that, well, there's these Halliburton guys and they're over here on these no bid contracts and they would, quote, run sailboat fuel, which is, you know, drive an empty truck and charge the government for moving it from one place to another.
The money.
And it's, oh, yeah, it all comes down to the money. And, you know, there was a lot of no bid contracts that went out.
Yeah,
and you know, that's everything is geared towards, you know, corporations and, you know, profiteering.
War makes money.
Oh, it does. It definitely
does. Not
for
us. Yeah. War loses money for us and makes money for a handful of people. You know, Eisenhower so presciently warned us about the military-industrial complex as he was leaving office. He was a brave soul to say it, and it's his Words have come true, unfortunately.
Yes, they have. So let's remind everybody about the vigil for Hiroshima Day, when it's going to be, which is tomorrow, and exactly where it's going to be and what time.
Yes, Marine Park downtown on the waterfront, and from 12 to 1, please join us. And this is sponsored by Juno People for Peace and Justice.
All right, Dr. Elaine Schroeder, thanks for being our first guest on the show today.
And thank you.
And just because it sounds like it fits in here, I'm going to run John Lennon's Imagine.
Yeah.
It's 3:24 p.m. You're listening to KTOO in Juneau 104.3, and this is a Juneau afternoon. That last little bit was from Japan's Spirit of Water. I thought it was kind of important to play something that was just a little bit Japanese for Hiroshima Day tomorrow, so we ran just a little bit of that. My next guest in the studio is from the city and borough of Juneau. It's part of a continuing series of just trying to figure out the different departments in this city and what everybody does. So next guest here is Greg Cheney, and he's from the City and Borough of Juneau Lands Department. Welcome, Greg, to the show. How are you?
Well, great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Okay, and what does the Lands Department do?
Well, really broadly, we're responsible for management of city property. That takes on a lot of different ways of going at it, but one of the things that people ask us about quite a bit is the city has a lot of property, but most of it is actually not on the road system. We have, you know, thousands of acres, but most of it's on hilltops, and most of the easy-to-get-to property was already deeded to the private sector long ago. So we'll have, 100 acres, but there won't be any way to get to it. But there are a few places that we have access to, and in those places we try to provide or make housing opportunities available to people. Right now we've got the trailing end of the Lena lot land sale, Lena subdivision land sale. So right now we're accepting bids on three properties out there, and the bids will close August 18th at 4:30 at our purchasing office. But if you're at all curious about it, you can go to our website, juneau.org, and look at news items. And we have, you can get some more information about the lots that are available. And if you're, have some more questions, you can call our phone number at 586-0224. That's 586-0224. And we're happy to talk to you about that. But that's just one thing that we're doing. We also have another subdivision coming up that's near Zontakahini Middle School in Schweitzer Creek area. That'll be a multifamily development, but that's probably going to be coming online around next year. There's a lot of prep for that, and we're working through that with an engineering firm right now. And then we haven't got our subdivision permit. We're going to be going through that process. So that's just kind of a early warning on that one, so people can be looking for that. And then the big thing that's going to be coming down is Peterson Hill, which is on the uphill side, if you're driving from Brotherhood Bridge towards the university. There's a fairly large bit of city property kind of behind Swampy Acres, that farm little place where they have horses and things. That area has been recently rezoned by the assembly to a mix of single-family and multifamily residential, and we're planning a very large subdivision back there, reminiscent of the style of the subdivisions that were done in the downtown core, something that would be more like a walkable neighborhood, a series of smaller lots kind of close together, but still single-family ownership where you own your own home on your own lot. And so, you have a yard where you can have your dog run around or plant tomatoes maybe not tomatoes. Maybe you could build a greenhouse. But that's the thing, it's your own land, and you don't have to ask anyone permission for what to do with it. Anyway, but we also have some multifamily property there as well. So that's going to be a larger subdivision. The next two or three years, that'll be maybe becoming available. But it takes a lot of prep to put something like that
on. Are they anticipating apartments or duplexes and quads, that kind of thing?
Well, actually, in the Peterson Hill area, now you might see that up in the Schweitzer Creek area, which is more like it's set up for a multifamily, more like an apartment complex or condominium. But in the Peterson Hill, we have a mix of, it's called D10SF, which is single-family residential, 10 units per acre. And that will be more like what you see in what we call the flats downtown near the federal building. We have lots of little lots with, relatively small houses just because that's what you put on a small lot, or maybe a medium-sized home, with a little front yard and a little backyard. And then we also have some areas that are multifamily, and those where you would see the duplexes or the apartment buildings or condominiums. So it'll be a blend. We haven't got it. It's not ready for prime time yet. We're still in the conceptual phase, but we're working for that.
Greg, what else do we have in the affordable housing kind of niche?
Well, you know, affordable housing is kind of the magic. It's sort of like the holy grail of what everyone wants. And that's why we're working hard to put out some lots for people to build on. And that's why we are going for the smaller lots, because most of the private sector right now is concentrating on large lot sizes, and generally for larger homes, because that's generally where the builders tend to make a little more money. But we're going to be trying to create an environment where it's advantageous to build a smaller home, and that generally translates to less expensive. But we also, Lands is also staffed the Affordable Housing Commission, and tonight we're having a meeting at 5:15. And so if anyone's interested, they can come to room 224 in City Hall. It's a public meeting. And, you know, we're talking about some loan programs to try to incentivize more for accessory apartments, for example, and maybe make it a little bit easier to get a loan for mobile homes. Those are, you know, in that's a sector of the market that is hard to get financed because the banks are reluctant to loan, but it's often a much lower entry. The barrier to entry is much lower to get into a mobile home. So if you can get financing, they're an attractive opportunity for a lot of folks. And so we're working on a program where we might be able to provide financing or at least assist in the financing of those loans. So that's something else we're working on, but we're working closely with the Affordable Housing Commission to make those programs happen.
Greg, what else can we get out of the Lands Department? Are you is your department responsible for cutting and burn permits?
Well, you know, we're responsible for a lot of things. Actually, burn permits are from the fire department, but we do monitor air quality in the wintertime especially. And what we do there is we have a sensor on Floyd Dryden Middle School in the Mendenhall Valley. And we look at the average air quality. And if the air quality is unhealthy, we can call burn bans for the Mendenhall Valley. And the area is generally from Montana Creek to the Mendenhall Glacier down to the airport and Fred Meyer. And that, you know, basically that's the whole valley. And we monitor the air quality there. And when the average gets to an unhealthy level, or actually before it gets to an unhealthy level, but when the trend is towards an unhealthy level, and we're monitoring particulates primarily, we'll call a burn ban. It means no burning of wood smoke or wood stoves to reduce the amount of wood smoke in the area. Because in the Mendenhall Valley, you get these really strong inversions in the wintertime. And so the smoke just goes up and it just sort of stops and just concentrates. And once you're keyed into it, you start looking in the wintertime in those really calm, clear days, you'll see just like a lid on the top of the Mendenhall Valley and the wood smoke starts building. And so we try to stop people from burning wood stoves before it reaches an unhealthy level.
And any other future projects that we can talk about?
Well, you know, we've got, you know, I was going to back up a little and just talk about how we've got authority to, or we manage lands for different reasons. One is for land disposal, which I talked about with the subdivisions. The other is land preservation for natural area parks and green belts and things like that. And we also have the active parks like playgrounds and ball fields. And in those areas, we're actually, you know, we don't want to lock too much land up into natural area parks, but we are you know, in a very methodical way, adding to our portfolio. And right now, a real exciting thing is the Southeast Alaska Land Trust is getting ready to donate 127 acres in the Mendenhall Valley to the city for open space. And that would be roughly from Montana Creek to the Mendenhall River, roughly where the Juneau Youth Services area is. And so that used to be a homestead, and it's come into the Southeast Alaska Land Trust. They own it now, and they're going to donate it to the city. So that'll create a wonderful capstone to our network of trails that run up along the Mendenhall River and the Montana Creek. And then at that point, it'll all be kind of united, so you can walk all the way from the Brotherhood Bridge up to the northern end of where the development starts of Mendenhall River or on Montana Creek. So that's another big thing to watch for. That'll be, come through the public process. So it's not just going to happen. We'll have to get approval to do that. But that's on the front burner.
Greg, does the physical size of the borough present any specific logistical problems as far as your oversight of the amount of land that you have?
Well, it's very unique. You know, Juneau is a very unique community because we're not only big, but we're isolated. And we're on the mainland, but we're kind of like an island. And so we have to be self-sufficient, which creates a lot of demand for services here. We have a pretty extensive harbor system. And I'll just kind of jump over and say that we have some enterprise boards that manage our property as well as the lands department, lands division. So we don't actively manage the waterfront in those areas that the harbor department has. They're an enterprise board, so they're fairly autonomous, but they have management authority on the harbors. Then we have Eagle Crest, which is a city-owned ski area, which is fairly unique in the country. Most ski areas are private, so that's another thing that makes it unique. And then we have the hospital, city-owned hospital, that we manage. We have an airport, which we manage, and we have our school district, but it's really unusual for a city and to be united with the borough and manage a ski area, a hospital, a harbor, and an airport. That is really broad in terms of mission, and that's why we have our enterprise boards to help manage it. But it's actually working pretty well, and so the city of Juneau offers services that are pretty much unparalleled, and that's due to our size and our isolation, I would say.
Okay, Greg Cheney, you're the first one in our discussion of the city borough and of Juneau. We're going to be going through different departments on mm-hmm. Tuesdays just to find out, enlighten everybody out there in the listening mm-hmm. area of what the city does and the different departments and mm-hmm. how they interact. But thank you very much for being the first guest in the series.
Okay.
And it was a pleasure having you on the show today.
Well, you're welcome. And we didn't even get through all of our stuff. So
what else you got?
Well, I didn't want to drag this out, but we also do rock sales. We have Stabler's Point Rock Quarry. So we sell rock for all kinds of development. Most of the hard rock that you see around town comes from our city rock quarry. And then we have gravel quarries or gravel pits up in the Mendenhall Creek area that we extract gravel from. But we try to save our gravel for city projects because gravel is funny. I never really thought about this before. Gravel is a fairly limited resource. It has to be deposited over time, and it's well sorted. And those are fairly rare deposits. But rock, we have a lot of rock. So we can sell that to the public. But we try to hold on to our gravel for city property. And we also monitor city property for hazardous trees. If there's a property that's near, private property that's near city property, and there's a hazardous tree there, we have an expert on staff that goes out and evaluates it. And if that tree looks like it might be a hazard to that private home or their a building, then we will remove that tree before it becomes a problem because public safety is our number one priority.
A lot more responsibilities than I thought you might
have.
Yeah,
oh yeah.
All right, and application of gravel on the road in the wintertime, is that going to be somebody out of transportation?
Public Works.
That? Public Works, we're going to talk to them probably
those guys.
In the next weeks to come.
Sure, sure. Okay.
All right, Greg, thanks again for being our guest and the first in the series on the city borough at Juneau and what the different departments actually do.
Thank you.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Tuesday. It's the 5th of August, 2014. It's the birthday of the great French short story writer Guy de Maupassant, born in Normandy, 1850. In just 10 years, between 1880 and 1890, he wrote most of the work for which he's remembered, 300 stories and 5 novels in 10 years. It's the birthday of Conrad Aiken, born Savannah, 1889, who, in his autobiography, Ushant, writes about the great trauma that befell him when he was 12. His parents were wealthy New Englanders. They'd moved south for his father's medical practice. The father, for whatever reason, became emotionally unstable and violent, and the boy woke one morning to the sound of gunshots and discovered his parents' bodies. His father had shot his mother and then killed himself. Aiken wrote about it in his autobiography and his own attempt at suicide, and his affairs, and also his many literary friendships, including a lifelong friendship with T.S. Eliot. They bonded over literature, but also drinking and crazy cat comics. And it's the birthday of Wendell Berry, born near Port Royal, Kentucky, 1934, 80 years old today, descended from a long line of tobacco farmers. He went off to Stanford to study creative writing, thought he would become a college teacher, went off and lived in Italy, taught at New York University, and then he got a job offer to teach at the University of Kentucky, and he and his wife decided they would move back home, leave New York, and buy a farm in the Kentucky River Valley, and he began writing about Kentucky in novels and poems and essays. Wendell Berry said, "I always loved to listen to the old people, and I heard a lot of talk. At least until the 1980s, I was working in the fields a lot with people whose language had not been the least bit touched by the media. They spoke a beautiful language, direct and strongly referential, as far as possible from pure poetry. I grew up around people who would entertain themselves by talking. There'd be a crew at work, and something remarkable would happen, and they would start telling about it as soon as it was over. Three or four would each tell a different version of it, and they'd be trying to get the language right." Wendell Berry, whose books include The Mad Farmer Poems, The Unsettling of America, Hannah Coulter, and many others. Here's a poem for today by Howard Nemiroff, Summer's Elegy. Day after day, day after still day, the summer has begun to pass away. Starlings at twilight fly clustered and call, and branches bend and leaves begin to fall. The meadow and the orchard grass are mown, and the meadowlark's house is cut down. The little lantern bugs have doused their fires. The swallows sit in rows along the wires. Berry and grape appear among the flowers, tangled against the wall in secret bowers. And cricket now begins to hum the hours remaining to the passion's slow procession down from the high place and the golden session wherein the sun was sacrificed for us. A failing light, no longer numinous, now frames the long and solemn afternoons where butterflies regret their closed cocoons. We reach the place unripe and made to know, as with a sudden knowledge, that we go away forever, all hope of return cut off, hearing the crackle of the burning blade behind us and the terminal sound of apples dropping on the dry ground. Summer's Elegy by Howard Nemiroff, from the collected poems published by the University of Chicago Press and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, produced by Joy Biles, assisted by Teresa Burgess. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
Support comes from Northern Audiology and Hearing Services in the Jordan Creek Center. Northern Audiology offers diagnostic medical hearing expertise and digital technology hearing instruments. 789-6780.
It's 3:43 p.m. Juno Afternoon continues, and if you are interested in being a guest on the Juno Afternoon show, if you've got a new business to promote or an upcoming organizational event or service, you can call Jeff Brown at 463-6425, and he will arrange to get you on our show. And now I'd like to continue with a short Spirit of Alaska Youth story, so let's listen in.
Spirit of Youth celebrates teenage Alaskans who are making our communities better places to live. They give their time, their hearts and minds, their passion, their creativity. Now, hear their stories.
I'm going to start with the creamy mustard of butter and sugar, and then I'll be alternating the flour and the milk and then adding in the vanilla.
Alexis Wells is 16 years old, and today she's hard at work in the student kitchen at the King Career Center. KCC provides vocational and technical skills education for the Anchorage School District, and it's where Alexis takes this culinary arts class. These yummy cupcakes she's making today are for a special occasion. She's going to sell them to raise money for her upcoming trip down south to compete nationally in the Skills USA Culinary Arts Challenge.
A pan-seared chicken breast with a mushroom pan sauce.
Hungry yet? That's what Alexis made and will make soon. Alexis recently qualified for nationals by winning the local Skills USA competition. She beat out her fellow classmates and other students from around South Central. KCC Culinary Arts instructor Kelly Puff helped Alexis prepare.
It's an all-day competition because there's several components to it. So she's competing against other kids and the clock. And then she has to be very precise with her skills. So it's not just about cooking chicken, it's cooking it to the correct temperature, not overcooking it, and making sure she gets a good sear on the chicken. You know, it was a lot of work, but it got her ready for the competition, and she went in with a lot of confidence.
And a lot of enthusiasm.
I love being in the kitchen. It just, like, makes my day. Good to be in there every day.
In the meantime, Alexis is practicing for her next big win. I'm Shanna Sheehy.
Give a young person you know a boost by recognizing the good things they're doing. Nominate at spiritofyouth.org.
Provided by the Alaska State Division of Behavioral Health.
This land is your land, and this land is my land. From the California to the New York Island. Redwood Forest and the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me. As I went a-walking that ribbon of highway, I saw above me that endless skyway. I saw below me that golden valley. This land was made for you and me. And rambled, I followed my footsteps through the sparkling sands of her diamond desert. All around me, a voice was sounding. This land was made for you and me. When the sun comes shining, as I was strolling, the wheat fields waving, the dust clouds.
Out on the Herbert Glacier Trail just north of Juneau in early November one year. As we poked along the trail at a leisurely pace, it gave me time to take notice of the different forest types we passed through, of the low-growing plants under the forest canopy and out in the muskeg. The leaves were down, so it made the plants easier to spot, but they weren't in flower, so I had to guess at their identities. Deer cabbage, rusty menzesia, blueberry, crowberry, but what really caught my eye was a scattering of highbush cranberry, short, leafless, 4 to 8 foot tall bushes sprinkled throughout the understory of the spruce forest. What stood out were the orange jewels of berries hanging singly and in small clusters from the bare branches, like ornaments on a Charlie Brown Christmas tree. While I passed up the first couple of bushes, after seeing them regularly spaced along the trail, I had to sample one to make sure. It had been several years since I'd seen highbush cranberry. I hadn't noticed many at all around Ketchikan when I lived there, but it was fairly common along the trout streams of my youth in Upper Michigan. I pinched off one of the translucent orange berries and popped it into my mouth. I gently bit down and, whoa, gee, a rush of tart, sour juice. My mouth waters just thinking about it. Yep, highbush cranberry, all right. I mentioned to my companions that I had seen enough to come back with a bucket. One asked me what I did with those berries. Make jelly. Great jelly. He told me that a friend of his had once made a delicious pie with highbush cranberries. Unfortunately, his friend hadn't removed the seeds, and these berries are mostly seed. Now, highbush cranberry isn't a real cranberry like the bog cranberry used for sauce in the holiday season. Highbush cranberry is a viburnum, a member of the honeysuckle family. Highbush cranberry is the only viburnum that occurs in southeast Alaska that I'm aware of. It grows in moist forests, forest edges, on rocky slopes, and along streams. This bush has what's called opposite leaves. What that means is that along the stem, wherever a leaf grows out of one side of the stem, there's a similar leaf growing out of the opposite side. Highbush cranberry fruit is like a cherry, technically called a drupe, which is a fruit with a pit. Each berry is about 1 to 1.5 centimeters long, and for folks like me who don't speak metric, that's roughly between 3/8 and 1/2 inch. It has a flattened seed. The taste is very acid or sour. But there's also a wild, tangy flavor that might be more of a smell than a taste, and it's that quality that makes it one of my favorite berries for jelly. What is also nice about the highbush cranberry, besides not having to be hunched over for hours on end picking them, is the fact that these berries will hang on to the bushes long after summer ends and often well into winter, and that's just fine with me. The berries ripen and get juicier the longer they go, and when the leaves fall, they're a lot easier to spot by birds and us berry pickers. Well, I went back to that spot with my daughter, and we spent an afternoon picking highbush cranberries. The bushes weren't concentrated, but spread out over a large area. Birds and other berry pickers had found the patch, and it took a fair amount of walking during the hour and a half we picked, but we gathered close to 2 quarts of berries, enough for a small batch of jelly. It's been quite some time since I've been involved in jelly making, particularly highbush cranberry, so I called an expert for advice. Mom, we picked a bunch of berries and I'm ready to make jelly, but I can't find a recipe. To her credit, she gave me the recipe off the top of her head. First, she said, get a package of Sure Gel. Then she said to follow the directions inside the package for cherry jelly. And if we didn't have enough juice for a batch, we could add apple juice to the cranberry squeezings. Well, I had a box of Sure Gel, but inside there were no directions for cherry jelly. Uh-oh. But then I looked through my Cooking Alaskan cookbook and found a recipe. First thing you need are cranberries. Okay, so far. You're supposed to heat up the cranberries with a couple of cups of water, first to a boil, then simmer for 10 minutes. You need to mash down the cranberries, because they don't just turn into juice on their own. Here's the first tip I have for you. You might want to make sure the berries are covered by water. I used a potato masher, and those little berries explode under pressure. I had to clean up little red cranberry spots off the stove, the kitchen counter, the refrigerator, the cupboards, and even the ceiling, not to mention my white sweatshirt. After simmering this concoction, everything needs to be strained. The recipe calls for several layers of cheesecloth. No luck there, but I lined my colander with coffee folders, and that worked. About a half hour later, I had close to the 5 cups of juice needed for jelly. Now this recipe called for pectin, not powdered sugar gel, so I had to go to the store to see if I could find a bottle of pectin. More confusing was the fact that the recipe called for a half bottle of pectin, but it didn't say half of how large a bottle. Well, after a long and diligent search, I finally found liquid pectin in little foil pouches. The package said that one pouch was the equivalent of one half bottle of pectin. What, these guys don't measure things in ounces, cups, or tablespoons? So far, so good. Now, 7 cups of sugar. I was really tempted to reduce the sugar, but I was warned that the exact ratio of pectin to juice to sugar was all worked out to a degree of precision that would make scientists that designed the Mars rovers envious. So maybe I'd better not tinker with the recipe. We added the sugar and brought the whole mess to an odorific boil. The second tip I have for you isn't really a tip. It's a warning. Boiling highbush cranberries causes a stink. My mother said it always reminded her of old gym socks. Anyways, we added the pectin and boiled it again for another minute. We skimmed off the foam and we poured the resulting bright red clear liquid into jelly jars. It was good to hear the lids pop when the jars cooled down enough to seal. The next morning, I spread my toast with that perfectly formed jelly, and it was just like I remembered when I was young. Highbush cranberry jelly is tart and sweet and wild at the same time, with a flavor enhanced by its sharp woodsy aroma. I like to put cranberry jelly on pancakes instead of syrup. I've also had thumbprint cookies with a dollop of cranberry jelly in the middle. Pretty good stuff. Highbush cranberries hang on well into late fall or early winter, so if you're out and about some nice fall day, spend some time out in the woods on the trail of the wild highbush cranberry. Pick a bunch, make some jelly, and you can enjoy that reminder of wild places and wild things all winter long.
This station receives support from Canyon Hydro, providing maintenance, inspection, and repair services to remote hydro producers with fly-in service available. Information about these services can be found at canyonhydro.com.
This is Bird Note.
The most significant things in the world happen because of the actions of a few people, whether it's in research, politics, and in some cases in conservation.
George Archibald, co-founder of the International Crane Foundation. At one stage, there were only 15 whooping cranes left in the entire world. Now there's something in the region of 600. That's largely thanks to the work of the International Crane Foundation and its network of dedicated supporters from all over the world. But how do you build such a network?
I would meet kindred spirits and continue to meet kindred spirits that have the spirit of caring and interest. And you know that if you invest in that relationship, it's going to be productive.
Archibald is following in the tradition of great naturalists like Aldo Leopold and Henry David Thoreau.
And when you go into various parts of the world and you see these wonderful young people, you wonder, who's the Leopold in that group? And they're there. And that's one of the most exciting parts of my work, is discovering these wonderful kindred spirits.
Who do you think might be the next Leopold or Thoreau in your community? If he or she has an inspiring story, let us know at birdnote.org.
It's 3:50 8 p.m., and you are listening to KTOO in Juneau 104.3. Tonight's forecast is calling for mostly cloudy skies with scattered showers, lows in the low 50s. Tomorrow, cloudy with scattered showers, highs around 62 with light winds becoming southeasterly at 10 miles an hour in the afternoon. Tomorrow night, cloudy with scattered showers, lows in the low 50s again, and light winds. This is KTOO in Juneau. We broadcast on 104.3 FM in downtown Juneau and Douglas. KTOO also broadcasts on the following translators. In the Valley and Auk Bay areas, you can tune to K276 AF 103.1. Lemon and Schweitzer Creeks, K269 AO at 101.7. Gustavus listens in on K201 AM 88.1. K220 BT serves Hoonah at 91.9. In Excursion Inlet and Icy Strait, you can hear us on K210 AS 89.9. In Juneau, you can get us on GCI Digital Cable, channel 871. We are also online on KTOO.org. So if you miss a Juneau afternoon or you want to hear it again, you can find it in the local programs link on our homepage. I'm Ken Fix. I've been your host and hope to see you again next Tuesday.
Hamas believes it proved that violence